Now let's return to our panel for some comments more specifically about aviation electronics. Warren Swanson, President, Los Angeles Division of North American Rockwell, has some specific challenges for the designer of onboard avionics.
The prominence accorded avionics is exemplified by the impact of avionics in the sizing of environmental control and electrical power generating systems and the priority given to the avionic installation provisions. In a typical military airplane, the avionic subsystem consumes as much as 66% of the electrical power and 90% of the environmental control system output. The diameter of the nose of most fighter and bomber aircraft is sized by the dimensions of radar antennas. Sensors are located to provide required fields of view, and this frequently dictates the location of equipment compartments in order to minimize transmission line lengths. It is not uncommon to find equipment displacing fuel cells or located in wing roots and tail surfaces. The integration process is planned in detail and executed systematically to assure that the completed system meets users' requirements with respect to install performance, interface compatibility, cost, and schedule goals. Development of avionic subsystems as an integral part of a total aeronautical system presents many challenges to both the supplier and the system builder. From the viewpoint of the latter, the increased impetus placed upon avionic utilization has amplified some old problems and created new ones. A typical problem which exists as a result of the rapid technology expansion is a difficulty experienced in establishment of standards. In the commercial field, the Airlines Electronic Engineering Committee has done a commendable job in establishing standards for the air transport industry. The Air Inc. characteristics document have made a significant contribution to the reduction of procurement and operating costs while providing a standard of quality and performance which meets the needs of the user. In the field of general aviation, standards are practically non-existent, with the exception of those cases where airline type equipment is used. Unfortunately, the airline type equipment frequently exceeds the requirements of the general aviation user and is consequently not cost effective. The solution to the standardization problem is a complex one requiring the cooperation of manufacturers and users of avionic equipment, but a greater degree of standardization will benefit all concerned. Turning to another consideration, a paradox of the technology boom, is that although microminiaturization and integrated circuits have resulted in a dramatic reduction in component weight for a given function, there has not been a corresponding reduction in overall avionic subsystem weight for most aeronautical systems. This is due to the addition of new devices to the avionics inventory and the use of duality to improve reliability. As a consequence, weight continues to be an important factor in the selection of avionic components for aeronautical systems. Let's briefly review from the viewpoint of the aeronautical systems supplier some of the reasons avionic weight is so critical. Assume that we are designing an aircraft to specifications calling for a certain operating range, payload, and speed. To obtain this performance, a vehicle configuration is selected, which has a specified aerodynamic drag, fuel capacity, engine thrust, payload capacity, and subsystem complement. The configuration has a takeoff gross weight consistent with these parameters. Included in the takeoff gross weight is an avionic subsystem weight allocation, including equipment, antennas, and provisions. Provisions include the mounts, attachment hardware, cabling, connectors, cooling ducts, and where appropriate, RF transmission lines. Although actual values vary with specific locations and other installation considerations, provisions generally weigh 20 to 25% of uninstalled equipment weight. In addition to the direct avionics weight allocation, there are increments of aircraft subsystems attributable to support of avionics, which amount to approximately 25%. The most important of these are structure, electrical power, and environmental control subsystems, that the avionics account for a dead weight increase, which is typically 150% of the weight of the equipment itself. The effects of adding weight to an aircraft appear ultimately as increased vehicle size and weight or loss in performance. Growth factor is a term used for the ratio of increase to takeoff gross weight required to maintain a specified level of performance to original increase in dead weight. For example, a growth factor of 6 means that adding 100 pounds of dead weight to the airplane would result in a net increase of takeoff of 600 pounds to hold a specified performance. During the design phase, when growth factor applies, an equipment increase of 10 pounds in an SST-type aircraft results in a deadweight increase of 15 pounds. Applying a growth factor of 5, this results in a gross weight increase of 75 pounds, of which 25 pounds is the weight empty. The weight empty increase translates to a cost increase in the price of the vehicle of approximately $2,500. The remaining 50 pounds is for additional fuel, which costs approximately $875 per year, or $13,120 over a 15-year useful life. Thus, the net cost to the user of a 10-pound avionic weight increase amounts to $15,620. To illustrate the cost impact of reduced payload, consider an operational SST in which additional avionic equipment weighing 50 pounds is installed. With installation provisions, the deadweight increase amounts to 75 pounds. A payload reduction of 75 pounds over the useful life of the aircraft will result in a revenue loss of $373,000. A 747-type aircraft with the same increase would sustain a revenue loss of $124,000. Clearly, avionic subsystem weight has a profound effect upon aircraft takeoff gross weight and ultimately a cost impact beyond the cost of the actual equipment. Higher avionics weight during the design phase results in a larger vehicle requiring larger engines, more fuel, and more structure. An increase in avionics weight in a production airplane results in a loss of payload miles, which translates directly to dollars for an operator, military, commercial, or private. Next, let us consider the environmental control. There are three areas of avionics environmental design that warrant consideration and examination. Duplication of environmental avionic and aircraft provisions. Thermal packaging. Definition of equipment limitations and heat loads. The general avionics specifications call out design levels that require minimum support from the air vehicle. There is a little or no differentiation between normal condition and emergency or storage environments when specifying the required performance, life, and reliability. As a result, most units are built with expensive, high-temperature components and with numerous internal protective provisions such as sealed cases, heat exchangers, cold plates, heat sinks, heat rails, heaters and controls, filters, and internally and externally mounted blowers. These items are needed to cope with the excessive altitude and temperature extremes and the contaminants such as moisture and sand and dust. At the same time, for example, the general specification for air vehicle environmental control, MIL-E 38453, requires that air delivered directly to the equipment shall be totally devoid of entrained moisture. If these requirements are met by both the avionics and the aircraft manufacturers independently, it is evident that the resulting duplication of provisions could be traded against the weight and cost of providing a more ideal environment from the air vehicle. The second area of improvement is that of more efficient thermal packaging. Environmental specifications with worldwide exposure requirements tend to ensure that any packaging concept will protect the components from all undesirable environments to the maximum levels, even though the units will be protected to a certain degree by the aircraft installation. This concept is carried from unit to subunit levels, thus ensuring many layers of protective shells, with each one adding further resistance to the effective heat transfer. An important factor is the level at which maintenance requires the ability to remove and replace parts. In any conduction heat transfer path, the contact resistance between two removable parts in probably the highest single resistance to heat flow. The result is usually an excessive temperature differential above the cooling source and a requirement for a higher coolant flow or cold ambient temperatures. Packaging concepts should consider the objective of low temperatures between the components and the heat sink, and lowered coolant flow requirements. A third area of improvement is a precise definition of the power duty cycle with a more realistic definition of the electrical heat absorbed by the aircraft environmental control system. In the majority of avionic units, essentially all the power supplied is converted into heat energy that must be removed at a safe temperature level. The safe temperature level and the energy level determine the type and capacity of a given environmental control system. The value of heat dissipation power is generally set considerably higher than the nominal operating level of a typical unit in order to allow delivery of the majority of units under acceptance tests. A more reasonable power or heat dissipation requirement would be one based on the average power consumed during the operation. Experience has indicated that actual heat dissipation has tended to be approximately 50% of rated loads. The present aircraft environmental control system weight, when divided by the power dissipated, is a ratio of 20 pounds of ECS per kilowatt for forced air cooled equipment. High power transmitting tubes such as TWTs and their associated power supplies, which are used in radar and electronic countermeasures equipment, can operate efficiently at temperatures approaching 200 degrees. These components can be cooled by a fluid transport system. The ratio of weight of a typical refrigeration system to a high-temperature fluid transport system is 6-1. The performance and capacity of a given environmental control system at the specified operating conditions are entirely independent of the parameters that set the avionics heat loads. Consequently, the exact match of ECS capacity with avionics system requirements can normally occur only at one specific design point. However, all conditions must be considered simultaneously for both systems to ensure adequate ECS capacity. Once these conditions are established with reasonable accuracy, then the ECS can be trimmed to the matching point with a consequent reduction in weight and cost. So the performance and utility of aeronautical systems is expected to grow significantly during the 70s. The incorporation of new devices and new applications as integral parts of the system will require continued emphasis on integrated design by both the avionic and aircraft industries. Only through understanding and coordinating effort can mutual problems of this nature be solved to the best advantage of the users. The considerations discussed here are fundamental, but their impact on the total system effectiveness is great.
Anchorman on our panel is James C. Elms, director of DOT's Cambridge, Massachusetts Electronics Research Center. Jim points out some new tricks in reliability and use of redundancy.
Consider the cost of one canceled flight of an airliner of the 70s, all loaded full of passengers and baggage and ready to go. And you can understand why some thought is now being given to four-way redundancy systems. One system can be inoperative, and you still have triple redundancy left and available for takeoff. As far as safety is concerned, before one wants to depend upon a completely electrical connection between his control wheel and the controlled surface, he'd like to be convinced that the electronic system is at least as reliable as the basic structure. Before he wants to land hands-off and blind, he wants to be assured that the reliability is as high as in VFR. And in this case, he may well insist upon an independent monitoring system just to make sure. These are deep and hard reliability requirements. Here we can thank the space program, and particularly the man program, for a well-learned lesson. 20 years ago, we began applying the science of statistics to reliability. Evaluations of the Navajo missile, in fact, it was more general. It was of the Navajo missile and the upcoming Atlas missiles in general in that era. And these well-meaning gentlemen had proved without doubt that it was impossible for these things to fly because the mean time to failure of the total system would be approximately 1 minute. Well, anyway, this business of statistics and reliability did provide some new insight into the problem and certainly new incentives for improvement. But in my opinion, after that beautiful start, it certainly became very much overdone. In some cases, it had just simply evolved from the statistics of reliability to the statistics of failure. The manned space program provided us with a new incentive. It's very little solace to say to an astronaut, this electronic device on which your life depends can only fail once in 10,000 times, particularly if he's personally involved at that one time. You all have heard of the statistician who drowned while wading across a river whose average depth was 3 feet. The space program provided a motivation for a better approach to reliability. It also provided a requirement for a new approach. Statistics and statistical tests, while they have an important place when applied to large quantities, present real difficulties when applied to the small numbers of exceedingly complex systems and space vehicles. Reliability cannot be tested into a product, it must be designed into it. Now, reliability, depending on where you are in the electronics business, means different things. The first thing that you think about is the reliability of the individual devices, which are now becoming little systems in themselves. The next kind of reliability that people look at is the reliability of redundancy. And simple redundancy, of course, is simply having three gadgets that do the same thing. And when two of them say go left and one of them says go right, you go left. This is a very useful type of redundancy, and it's used a great deal. However, now we're starting to look at some various forms of organized redundancy. Supposing you have a system that requires three instruments, and you want triple redundancy, then the simple way to do it is to have 9 instruments. If you think about it a little bit and organize it a little, maybe you can get by with 6, any 3 of which will do the job. Then you have a slightly more elaborate voting system to figure out which 3 you're going to use. The trade-off there is the equipment to figure out which ones are working, the self-test feature as compared with the weight, cost, and complexity and maintenance problems of larger redundancy. So it goes from there into more elaborate types of redundancy. One of the most interesting ones is coming to be known as graceful degradation. You organize a system so that as it fails, it gradually loses capability. Instead of working at full capacity up to a point and then failing entirely. Here is the challenge for the 70s for the electronics engineer. Design for greater reliability. Do this to make more complex systems feasible and economically justifiable. Do it to reduce the expense associated with excess maintenance problems. And do it to ensure the necessary standards of safety for these new systems we're looking forward to. And remember that reliability should be designed in at every level of complexity. An element or a device doesn't know whether it's going on the grand tour to the outer planets, to the moon for further manned exploration, to orbit the Earth in an application satellite, or to help make the supersonic transport a safe and economically justifiable vehicle. But increased reliability makes the grand tour possible, It makes the moon exploration safe. It makes the communication satellite cheaper. And it makes the supersonic transport feasible. Thank you.
To give Soundings listeners a first-hand idea of air traffic control from the working end, we arranged to visit Flight Safety Incorporated, a firm which specializes in flight and instrument training. Through use of large, highly automated flight simulators, crews are trained to handle special avionics equipment and to navigate under any conditions. Let's simulate a takeoff and ILS landing in the Falcon, a popular corporate jet, with C.B. Keck, Flight Safety's instructor for this particular simulator. C.B. plays the role of traffic controller and sets up problems for the crew. The importance of voice communication should be clear from this example. Since we wanted to simulate only a landing, we had little time for the flight itself. Let's hear how CB arranged for a very short flight.
We're cleared for takeoff at this point. Instructor's given the instructions, and you can hear the noise. And we've lifted off. Was that a fire? He started a fire. We had a little problem here on takeoff. Fire number one engine. The red fire indicator came on, and the red knob is the extinguisher, is that right? That he pulled. This is a twin-engine jet. Fortunately, our pilots took care of the problem, and we seem to be maintaining forward progress.
We're climbing to 1,000 feet now. Falcon 247, you're clear to climb. Runway heading to 2,500 feet. Steer right to heading of 220.
Roger, runway heading 2,500 feet and right to 220. 247, we've got an engine fire and
go back and landing.
We're requesting to an emergency coming around to land.
Roger, maintain a heading of 220, be radar vectors to runway 4, expect an ILS to 4, present weather is 800 feet, 2 miles, wind is 040 at 10.
Roger, 220, 2.5
miles, ILS runway 4. Right now he's flying the flight director, and the main idea is to keep the airplane in the B bars. See the yellow B bars?
Right.
He programs his computer for an ILS approach. See, the flight director will give you the picture of the approach, and you can either hand fly it or hook it up to the autopilot and let the automatic
system. So the ILS glide path and localizer indications come in how?
They come in electronically, and you have two presentations. The V-bars will give you the indication of the localizer, which is your course. And then we have an indication off to one side, which is these white arrows.
This is more complex equipment than you find in the smaller planes, is it?
Yes, sir. It's very expensive.
Where are we now?
We're on the downwind leg. They're under radar vectors. They're climbing through 2,000 feet on a heading of 220. Radar will take them out about 10 miles due to the emergency condition. Cut them back in on a intercept back to the localizer. Now, as we're outbound, you can see the aircraft on the lower instrument.
Yes.
See the light or the localizer off
yes.
to the right.
Right.
Now, as he goes out, we'll turn right, turn back in to intercept that white localizer.
So there essentially is a vertical line that represents the localizer.
Localizer course.
Yes.
Now, as he's going by the station, on the flight director above, you see the arrow, the white arrow off to
yes,
one side?
Yes.
That is the glide slope. It shows he's above glide slope.
I see.
When that hits the middle marker beyond the glide slope.
So the two instruments that are directly in front of the pilot and just above his control are the critical ones. They're tied to the instrument landing system.
Right. The bottom instrument is raw data. That is the exact signal from the station. The top signal is programmed through a computer and gives him a command to put him where he's So in other words, he programs his flight director.
Yeah, so it's somewhat redundant then. If the computer isn't working, he still has the lower instrument.
That's right. Really, the top instrument is a command to get back to course. It doesn't tell you where you are. If you follow those commands, it will take you to the localizer. Cleared right to heading 360. Cleared to intercept the localizer. Cleared for an ILS approach to runway 4. And if you watch the airplane on the lower instrument, which is a hard data, see the airplane swinging around heading towards the localizer course. In other words, he can see in the bottom instrument where he is at all times. And he flies the top instrument, which is a computed data, to get him. And the top instrument computes crosswind.
And how does it get the crosswind data?
By its closure rate. See, actually, the lower instrument, the localizer course, is actually an ammeter.
Yes, I understand.
And as it comes across, the signal gets stronger.
Right.
So it takes the rate that the signal
falls. Okay. So actually, it must be a differentiator, which, as we electrical engineers know, is not the best of all possible circuits.
Right. Well, this works real well. So you're starting to turn him in on the localizer.
Yeah.
And what it will do, it'll pick up the maximum signal strength and hold that. And if it starts to slide off, it detects a crosswind and brings him back over to the max signal. He's now on the localizer course, just slightly to the left of it. But it'll make the corrections to bring him back. Now he is on a horizontal plane at 2,500 feet.
Right.
He's on the localizer course, headed down the runway.
Right, about how far off the end of the runway are we?
Right now, he's 12 miles out from the runway.
And we tell that from?
We have a DME, which is distance measuring equipment.
I see. And the DME works on the same antenna site as the localizer?
Not always, no. If it's a TVOR station, which is a special type station, the DME might be on the same airport.
About how sensitive is the DME? You read to what distance?
It's a speedometer type, rotating disc. And you can tell a half mile. Get a signal by the aircraft, which is interrogated and bounce back.
And that's the principle of the DME and the TACAN both.
TACAN is simply the Air Force, and it has different channels. Marker beacon's about 8.7 miles.
About 8.7. That's not a standard, is it?
No.
Just in this particular case.
Actually, we'll have two marker beacons here. We'll have one at the 8.7 miles, and then we'll have one at what we call the outer mark, which is about...
We're looking at the map for this particular...
3.2 miles.
3.2 is the middle beacon, or the...
This is the outer marker. Then we have a middle marker, which
middle marker is
7/10.
7/10 of a mile.
Now, if you notice, we're coming in still on the horizontal plane at 2,500 feet, but the arrow to the right of the flight director, see it starting to make its way down?
Yes.
That's the glide slope. Now, when that hits the center, we'll have intercepted a glide slope, and we'll start our descent, keeping that in the center.
You go on a level flight until you intersect the glide slope,
right,
and then you proceed at a constant angle down.
Right. In this case, it's a 3-degree glide slope. If you watch his technique as he intercepts a glide slope,
he'll compensate by human servo control, I suppose you might say.
See, he's already started a shallow rate of descent. You noticed at that time the runway picture came up below the V-bars?
Yes.
That shows that he has intercepted a glide slope. Now we have captured the localizer.
Now we're
and the glide slope, and we're all the way ready.
We're beginning to see some of the lowered stability due to the low speed, I presume, on the aileron control. Or do we have a crosswind?
We might have a slight crosswind today.
That's very good.
But if you notice, he's following the computer commands at the top. The computer is taking care of any crosswind.
When he hits the inner marker beacon, he should have the runway in sight. Is that correct?
No, it depends on the weather.
I see.
In other words, he can go down on this approach to 200 feet and a half mile.
Will he typically have local terminal radar control also watching for him? Or?
At the larger airports, they have. In fact, the towers have radar now.
Yes.
It's coming up on 4 2/10 miles.
So we should see the marker. See the marker beacon soon. How will that appear?
All right, the marker, see the needles on the far right there?
Yes.
The one going around?
Yes.
That shows a passage of the station.
Which of the outer marker is a low frequency beacon?
Okay. It would have an outer marker light also. Now, see, he's slightly above the glide slope at this time, but he's making correction. Now, a normal 3-degree glide slope at this speed would take about a 700 foot a minute.
Yes, we're slightly to the left of the glide slope, but to the left of the localizer, are we not?
And he's just coming back on glide slope.
Right.
See the localizer swinging underneath the
mountain? Yes.
As he uses trim and as he changes the stabilizer, the clack sound shows that the stabilizer is moving to follow his control.
I get you.
It's a motion indicator because the tail is such a large control force. Now, if you notice here, this localizer, like quite a few of them, has a flat spot where he had to level out momentarily, and now he's
That's
coming.
Because of the antenna pattern being distorted by the ground or by something else?
It can be by any object, a truck driving by.
Even a truck driving by can change it.
Or if there's another airplane on the localizer ahead of you.
That's
one reason why we shouldn't have two in close proximity making
that
approach. Well, you'll find in the large airports that they'll have a yellow strip, and they'll say that on the strip that you're entering the localizer critical area.
What was that noise?
That was the brakes.
The brakes. Are we down?
No, we're on the ground.
What a relief.
He's just touching down.
I didn't even feel a thing.
Good landing.
Oh, it was an interesting experience. Thank you very much, CB.
Sure thing.
And that is how pilots learn to use the many flight aids, realistically, but in complete safety.
This is your editor, Walt Beam, at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York, wishing you a bon voyage on your next air flight and reminding you that today's and tomorrow's comfortable and safe air travel is due in large part to developments which you, the electronic engineers of the United States, have contributed to society.